I remember before there was unlimited texting. Parents would come into my office with a stack full of bills from their provider,
mm-hmm.
you know, and their bill was $3,000 for 1 month.
Yeah.
And the parents are like, it's out of control.
Do you identify with that at all? I hope not. This is Mike Trout, and you're listening to Come Receive the Light. And one of our two conversations today is going to zero in on youth or children and technology.
So much of it is so graphic to entice the person to go from that, from just the texting to actually meeting up with somebody and actually acting out these fantasies that they are having.
It certainly can be a desperate time for parents, and we're going to offer some hope and some help on today's edition of Come Receive the Light. Our host is Father Christopher Metropoulos, and our second conversation is going to be about the Great Schism.
I think what made the schism irrevocable was what happened in the next century, in the 12th century, mm-hmm. with the Crusades and the series of misunderstandings that the Crusades gave rise to.
And welcome again to Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network. And we are so grateful and thankful that you have taken these few minutes out of what can be a very busy schedule, especially at this time of year, and spend them with us here on this broadcast. If you're brand new to the program, please go to our website at myocn.net. That's myocn.net and learn more about us. I'll have additional details as well as we get a little deeper into the broadcast. Our first conversation today is going to be with Father Andrew Louth, who's a professor of patristic and Byzantine studies at the University of Durham, England. He's back for his third conversation in a four-part series dealing with his book Greek East and Latin West, The Church, 681 AD to 1071. And our focus today is on the Great Schism, and conducting the interview is our host, Father Chris.
Great to have you back with us again, Father.
Good to be with you.
Now, this isn't a new topic for most Eastern Orthodox. What are the three things that we should really link in our minds to this event?
I think that there are probably, well, let's say take three things. One, I think, would be that it takes place in the 11th century, or rather, it is always thought to be, to reach its climax in the 11th century. I'll come back to that later. But then the 11th century is an extraordinarily important period for Western Christendom, in that the 11th century is the period of what's sometimes called the papal reform movement. It's the period in which the papacy develops and becomes a recognizable, powerful institution within the Western Church. Secondly, it's a period when contact in East and West was probably becoming greater and greater, mostly as a result of the increase in trade between East and West. The third thing I think to remember about it is that the Great Schism doesn't really describe an event, but a period of estrangement that took place over a very, very long period. And I'm not really sure that it is makes a lot of sense to single out the 11th century, though it's become emblematic in the kind of the sort of memory of the Church.
Now, we talked last time about some of the things that led up to the Great Schism. In your opinion, had the East and West just reached a point where there was no solution other than separation, or was this kind of a shock even to church leaders?
I think that it probably had got to the point by the 11th century where, in the end, there was going to be some sort of split. But I don't think anybody thought of it in those terms. And I don't actually think that any of the events of the 11th century left people in the 11th century with the sense that the Church was irrevocably divided. I think what made the schism irrevocable was what happened in the next century, in the 12th century, with the Crusades and the series of misunderstandings that the Crusades gave rise to.
Did the average person really see this happening in their parishes? Did they know that the schism was coming to a boiling point, do you think?
It would depend where they were. I mean, the truth of the matter is mostly not. So there are parts of the world where I think the sense of schism would have been much more evident. I mean, one part, and indeed this is where, in some ways, where the events that led up to 1054 started, would have been in southern Italy and in Sicily, which had traditionally been a part of the Greek-speaking world, people, I think, in parishes would have been conscious that there were Latin and Greek forms of Christianity that were in some ways different, and particularly over sort of liturgical and sort of practical matters.
What role do you think the papacy played in the Great Schism? Because I've heard about the Orthodox side of it, but I've really never heard about what role the papacy might have played in this.
I don't think we can begin to understand the Great Schism without understanding the, as I said at the beginning, without understanding the papal reform movement and the way in which the vision of the papal reform movement was a kind of papal monarchy, that the Church was a body ruled by the Pope, as if he were the monarch of the Church, and archbishops and bishops and priests and the rest were, as it were, his servants and representatives. The Orthodox Church never had such a sense of any one see having such complete power. I mean, there were four patriarchates in the West, and even though it is true that by the 11th century, three of them were in the hands of the Muslims and were not very effective, Constantinople itself never quite got to the point of claiming that it was, as it were, the head of the Church.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's one element in it. I think the papal reform movement, part of it did think of itself as something that should extend throughout the whole Church, not just throughout the Latin Western Church.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think there was a sort of conscious policy of doing this. But I think it's much more at the level of the fact that when the two churches came to be involved over the issues that brought Cardinal Humbert to Constantinople, the papacy expected that its view on these things would be regarded as if not final, at any rate fundamental, and it encountered in Constantinople an attitude to the nature of the Church that didn't see anyone see as having this sort of final authority.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to ask you to go a little bit deeper than the books and possibly into the hearts of some of these people, the people that played out in this history. We know you're a historian. You know that usually history, it takes a while for people to actually take the history, read the history, digest the history, and then actually write about the history.
Mm-hmm.
I'm wondering, from your perspective, is there anything written about the Pope and the person, the Patriarch and the person, their own feelings during these times when these personal letters were going back and forth and this estrangement was hitting its peak? Is there anything written about that where we know more personally what these men went through during these times?
It's quite difficult. I mean, the papacy had just come through a century of considerable corruption in the 10th century, and the papal reform movement was a reform of the papacy itself.
Mm-hmm.
And the popes were generally men of very high esteem in the 11th century, and they were people who felt that they had a mission to reform the Church and to make mm-hmm. it effective as a means of spreading the gospel in the world.
Mm-hmm. Understood. Well, I know that there are talks going on now between Rome and Constantinople, and even some important liturgies that have been celebrated. I don't think they've been celebrated together, but in witnessing, the reading of the Creed. I've seen that done several times. What would need to happen in order to almost reverse that schism? I know that there were some very strong steps that were taken by the then Patriarch Athenagoras and Pope Paul, I think it was. But yes. Take us a little bit deeper into that, Father.
It looks as if, judging by the Ravenna statement, the agreement between the Catholic and Orthodox churches in Ravenna a few years ago, that many Orthodox would be prepared to accept some sense of a Petrine office within the Church. But I find it very difficult to see how the Roman Church could roll back a whole millennium.
Millennium, sure.
It seems to me that the structures of the Church have got more and more centralized in the last couple of hundred years, not less so.
And that centralization, obviously, for us as Orthodox, is a problem. We have a conciliar approach, so we don't have
exactly. One
man who, for lack of a better term, is not very theological, but runs the show. Let's put it that way, okay?
Exactly, yeah.
So if you have multiple people and their opinions coming in, and then, of course, the enhancement and the divine Holy Spirit that would guide us. Well, it's interesting, Father. It's interesting to learn, and I know many people, unfortunately, many people don't know their history. And when we don't know history is when we create themes and we create thoughts in our minds that aren't true, and then those actually take on a life of their own. So learning about the schism has been very important to us and especially to our listeners. Anything else you should like to add about it?
I think probably the most important thing I think to realize when I think about the Great Schism is that for all the profound effects that it has had in, as it were, separating Christendom into two parts, East and West, Latin and Greek, in fact, actually, we share far more than what separates us.
Mm-hmm.
That what we have in common is much, much greater than what separates us.
And I think that's very important. It's very important for our listeners to know. And we've always said that there is so much more in common than there is that divides us. And let's always go to that and to pray for it. Father, thank you so much for talking with us today. Listeners, you can look for the final installment of Father Louth's series with us next month. The previous episodes are available at myocn.net, and you can also find a new link to purchase Father's book there.
Well, I don't know what happened to the goodbye. I'm sure there was one, but we have been speaking with Father Andrew Louth, Professor of Patristic and Byzantine Studies, on this edition of Come Receive the Light. That was our host, Father Chris. And as he said, you can go to our website for a link to that incredible resource, that book, Greek East and Latin West. And our website again is myocn.net. That's myocn.net. When you go there, you'll also find a link to a brand new film called The Mysteries of the Jesus Prayer. Last week we had Father John McGuckin as our guest. He's been on Come Receive the Light a number of times. Well, he's a key ingredient in this brand new documentary. Again, it's called The Mysteries of the Jesus Prayer, and you'll find a direct link to additional information when you go to our website at myocn.net. You'll also find details about how you can become a financial partner with us. That is so important any time of the year, but especially here at the end of the year when so many people are thinking about year-end giving. The Orthodox Christian Network is a nonprofit outreach, and we depend entirely upon your generosity. And it's amazing how much we get done with how little income we see each year. If you'd like to make your shopping count, when you do your Christmas shopping via Amazon, there is a link on the OCN site that will take you to Amazon. And when you shop or buy something through Amazon, a portion of your purchase will come as a gift to the Orthodox Christian Network. And if you own a business and would like to participate with us by advertising on the OCN website, the details for that are on our homepage as well. That's myocn.net, and we look forward to hearing from you.
I think sometimes parents have a false sense of the fact that they are communicating these concerns is enough. A lot of parents don't even do that. So yes, I encourage the first step is to sit down and have this very serious and deep conversation with a child.
But there certainly is a step two and a step three and even more, and we're going to share all of that in the next conversation with our featured guest. And here with that interview is a guest host, Emmy Louveris.
Dr. Ari Christofidis, founder and director of the Orthodox Christian Counseling Institute, is with us today from Chicago. He's with me to talk about teens and technology. Welcome to the program, Ari.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me.
So this is such a timely issue and one that affects all of us. So teens spend so much time using various electronic gadgets.
Mm-hmm.
Can that be a problem in and of itself, regardless of what they're doing?
Yes, I think we are seeing some problems already. One of the things that has been coming up a lot lately is just the development of poor social skills by the younger generation, the early teens and later teens, even college students. I think because of the disconnect with the human being and doing so much socializing over gadgets that their social skills have dropped. In addition to grammar, writing skills, I think we're definitely seeing some problems here. And it's concerning a lot of people. I'm sure English teachers would back us up on that. The other thing that is of great concern is the addictive behavior we're seeing as part of these gadgets. And more kids are just unable to shut themselves off from these gadgets. And I'm quite concerned of the addictive quality there.
And there's so many of them. What are some things that parents can do to make sure that cell phones are a good thing in their teen's life rather than a negative thing?
Well, I think we're at a really difficult crossroads with looking at it outside of a couple good things. And I absolutely agree. It's a great tool for emergencies, without a doubt. And it's a great tool for a child, a teenager, to be able to contact their parents for any kind of message. And after that, I'm not seeing much good after that, unfortunately. I wish I could say, but I'm going to go on a limb here and say, you know, outside of emergency and being in touch with family members, there are more negative things that we're seeing come out of this. And it's very sad. But there's so much abuse of it. I remember before there was unlimited texting. Parents would come into my office with a stack full of bills from their provider,
mm-hmm.
you know, and their bill was $3,000 for 1 month.
Yeah.
And the parents are like, it's out of control. And so I think we have to take into consideration, we're dealing with children and the maturity level of a child, a preteen, a teen. They're still immature in many, many ways. And they're not able to kind of, in general speak here, of course.
Right.
They're not able to really hold themselves back from that temptation. And we're asking them to, but are we really asking them to do something that they're really not mature enough to handle? And that's a big question I think we have to face.
Right. There are a lot of concerns with texting, like we were saying, and the newer terminology for some parents who may not have heard it, the sexting,
mm-hmm.
it's an increasing concern.
What's happening, I think, is that, you know, let's say the more shy kids are using the texting as a testing ground to be a little bit flirtatious. And what's happening then is that they're taking that flirtation to a very dangerous level. And so they're starting to test and without boundaries. You know, they feel that the phone itself is that boundary. It protects them because mm-hmm. they don't have to face that person. But they're getting, as you said earlier, bold, very mm-hmm. bold and trying new things and new avenues to check in where the other person is. And this has become a way for them to kind of be more flirtatious without the consequences in their minds of any damaging effect of what they're doing. But they don't realize there is a great damaging effect. So they're saying things, they get beyond the very healthy, normal realm of, do you like me, I like you, let's go see a movie, to graphic.
Mm-hmm.
Dangerous sexual language that is really scaring parents. And again, I've had parents come in with some examples that'll just, you know, blow your mind.
Oh yeah,
you think is this coming from a 13-year-old's mind?
Mm-hmm.
And so much of it is so graphic to entice the person to go from that from just the texting to actually meeting up with somebody and actually acting out these fantasies that they are having. And so the scary part is that in the beginning, they think they're protected by the distance using the phone or internet. But then the danger often is that the one person on the other end may take that as a sign that they can move forward and do something even more dangerous. So these types of things, you know, may start off in an innocent way, but they quickly grow into something very dangerous.
And certainly, I mean, this is the point mm-hmm. that you have to, as a parent, be proactive. That mm-hmm. you have to kind of add, not kind of, you. It's imperative. You have to have this conversation now with your child about, you know, how to appropriately use technology and not to, you know, let yourself get roped into some of these things that are out there.
Yes, but I would add to it, I think sometimes parents have a false sense of the fact that they are communicating these concerns is enough. It's absolutely step one. And a lot of parents don't even do that. So, yes, I encourage the first step is to sit down and have this very serious and deep conversation with a child. But part two is when we falsely believe that our child and emotionally and mentally handle restricting themselves from so many of these temptations. So we're putting something loaded, so to speak, in their hands and saying, all right, but don't fire it.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, can you expect a 12-year-old, a 14-year-old, a 16-year-old to be able to withhold themselves from using, you know, whatever device it is in a completely safe way? And unfortunately, the answer is no. They just are not mature enough, most of them, to be able to restrict that temptation.
Yeah.
And so the danger is we're actually putting something that is more dangerous than not in their hands and then hoping and praying that they will use it wisely.
Right.
And I think parents are a little bit fooling themselves when they give something like a cell phone with no restrictions
mm-hmm.
to a child.
Yeah.
It cannot be 24/7.
What about video games? The concern used to be that it could damage kids' eyesight. But now the games themselves can be a problem. Not can be a problem. I think they are a problem. They're mm-hmm. violent. They're sexual. You know, talking about crossing the line and blurring the line of, you know, in the mind of a child, what is real and not real.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is a parent to do with that?
Unfortunately, too many parents are lax in their discretion when it comes to purchasing a video game. And not really taking a careful analysis of what is this game? Is it all about guns and violence? I mean, the technology is so good that the graphics are so lifelike.
Oh, yeah.
When they see blood and guts, so to speak, shown on the video screen. And then the sexual types of portrayals of women and relationships and abusive types of relationships in these video games are clearly not for children. And so the majority of these games really are not good for anybody, but especially the young souls, the young minds. I mean, we're talking about the innocence of children and how, you know, we can all say, how beautiful is that innocence? Well, why are we destroying or, you know, helping that child to lose their innocence by exposing them to such violence and sexual type behavior? And unfortunately, it's all over the place.
Yeah.
What message, internal, deeper spiritual message, is the child picking up on? They're picking up on behaviors that go completely against our faith. And so are these things really affecting us? Yes, they are. Are parents responsible? Absolutely. And they're not recognizing the long-term effects of giving kids what they want when they may not be healthy for their soul and salvation. They're thinking of the immediate situation. How do I make my child happy right now? But they're not thinking of the long-term consequence. You know, more and more exposure to these things stimulate the child's brain. It wires the child's brain a certain way. The child is looking for these kind of violent stimulations or anything that would stimulate to get that kind of emotional high. Unfortunately, it's all based on something that is very wrong and sinful and sometimes very evil. So now the child is kind of developing this way, rather than in a very loving, Christian, supportive, and positive way. They are turning away from that because of the stimulation and this addictive type of gaming that is going on out there.
Unfortunately, the parents are, I think, engulfed in it as well. And so, you know, you lead by example, and the parents have gotten themselves into a very similar, you know, we got the phone, we have the texting, we're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, we're doing it, our kids are doing it.
Yep.
You know, and the balance needs to, you know, take a step back and take a look at it and maybe reevaluate. You know, how much of that is good and how much of it is really now interfering in what is, as you were saying, important?
Well, I think they have to take a very serious moment to ask themselves as parents, what values are we trying to teach our kids in general? And how do these pieces of technology, how might they affect the life that we want to lead as a Christian family? How will they influence that? How will they interfere with that? How will it enhance, so to speak, our lives as a Christian family? And I think parents are too quick to just say, oh, yeah, that's okay, fine, everyone's doing it. Mm. And they're not really evaluating, I think, more deeply the long-term effect. They're just looking for the short-term effects, such as, oh, it's like the old saying, you know, well, I can't find a babysitter, put a movie on, that's our babysitter. You know, how do you just respond in a moment of crisis, so to speak? But this is much bigger than that. I was listening to an interview with one of the tech gurus out in California, and he was saying, he was in his 20s, he said some of his friends, if they lose their cell phone, it's like they've lost an organ. I mean, it's so important in their life that they can't sit still, they can't settle, they can't focus until they find that cell phone. And so it's, like you said, we're getting too many things are attached to us, but they're not healthy. So you have to, as parents, I believe, decide, okay, what are our limitations? Where are our boundaries when it comes to giving our child a cell phone or allowing your child to be on Facebook? And right away, I would say, if you give an inch, they may take a mile. You have to be able to hold back and just give them that inch. So as parents, you have to decide, you know, is it 10 minutes? Is it 15 minutes on Facebook and that's it, and back to schoolwork? If it's a cell phone, is it restricting their minutes and text? And if they go beyond that, they lose it. I mean, they have to enforce these things, or else the kids will abuse them by nature based on just natural immaturity.
Well, we certainly got to talk a lot about technology. I don't know that we solved the world's problems, but we certainly did look at it. And is there any place that you can refer to parents to get some more support?
Well, I think I would love for parents to take a moment and watch a Frontline episode. I thought they did a very good job. If people don't know, Frontline can be seen on PBS.org, and you can watch their programs online. And they did an episode last February, 2010, they called it Digital Nation. And I thought they did a decent job of educating the effects, at least some effects, that technology has had on the population as a whole, the effects on, they have an episode, a chapter in there about the effects on children in South Korea, which I thought was very good. And they also talk about the effects on the brain. So I thought that was very helpful.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. This was certainly an eye-opening conversation.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Well, that wraps up another edition of Come Receive the Light from the Orthodox Christian Network. I'm Mike Trout. And thanks again to our guest host, Emmy Luveris, for that interview. If you'd like to listen to all of this again, just go to our website at myocn.net. That's myocn.net. And do pray about the ways in which you can become involved with this ministry, perhaps as a financial partner. Click on that Donate Now button and read more. That's myocn.net. Our executive producer is Father Spiro Bobotis. Our programming director is Ann Dankert, and our host, of course, is Father Christopher Metropoulos. Do join us next week at this same time on this same station, and remember to always have faith in what you listen to.